A new report by the Australian Security Leaders Climate Group has outlined how the government's risk and security agenda fails to include climate change, leaving the country and the population vulnerable. The co-authors, including former Australian Defence Force Chief Chris Barry, say a continued failure to adequately account for the magnitude of the risks not only jeopardises the nation's future safety, but also puts at risk billions of dollars. Retired Admiral Barry says a visit to Australia by the former Chief of Defence of the Netherlands, Tom Middendorp, and his address at the National Press Club on climate security highlights how Australia is behind other countries when it comes to planning the response to climate security risks, with the goal of safeguarding the future stability of our region and beyond. I spoke with Mr. Barry for this edition of Weekend One-on-One.
Well, I think there are a number of facets to why Tom's visit to Australia is important. The first one, of course, is that he is a former Chief of the Defence Staff in the Netherlands and had significant experience between the year 2000 and his retirement, I think, about 6 years ago. Since that time, he's invested a lot of time and effort in thinking about climate change and its consequences, and he's written a book which is called The Climate General, in which he canvasses reflections on all those years of service and then translates all of that into what does the world look like today and why is climate change and its consequences such an important issue for us all to act on. So we're looking for him to come and support the agendas we've been running since 2021 and what we perceive to be a lack of traction with the coalition government before it was displaced by the Labor government. And even since then, despite the fact we were quoted in a platform for that election, dragging their heels on the climate change risk assessment and doing really the serious things that need to be done to head off the worst outcomes of climate change.
As you just stated there, you used the phrase lack of traction. In terms of this idea of viewing climate risks from this perspective of a national security issue, just how significant is that? Because when we talk about security issues, a lot of the airtime has been devoted to things like cybersecurity, for instance. But in terms of the ranking and priority of climate change being viewed from a defence strategic lens, what's your perception on the kind of urgency at this present moment?
Well, I think we've been rather blind to the serious issues now on climate change are what's happening around the globe is getting much more serious than we'd contemplated even 10 years ago. A lot of the worst that science pointed to, looked at happening later on the century, is happening now. For example, just look at the recent Hurricane Helene in the United States and its consequences in North Carolina, a state that used to say of itself, we are protected from climate change, and they've just run up in Australian dollars, $230 billion of damage claims, potentially, and that's about half the federal government budget for 1 year in this country. Now, these are the sorts of things that are coming down the road to us, and we look around and we look at new coal mines, we look at what's happening in the fossil fuel industry writ large. We look at the government dragging its heels on this climate change risk assessment, which we argued would have formed the basis for making serious plans to get things done. They handed it off to the bureaucrats. Communities haven't been involved. Frankly, I think they've wasted the last 2 years not getting very far. So that's a lack of traction that I see.
In terms of the integrated whole of government response that you'd like to see, there are four steps outlined in this report. Recognition, first of all, that this is a security threat. Climate Threat Intelligence Unit, an early warning system to be coordinated by such a unit. And an implementation of a methodology, climate risk management. How far along are we on any of those fronts? You've just alluded to even an inability to get the transparent release of the National Climate Risk Assessment and having communities involved in that discussion. But you've
Yeah.
centered the report on these four steps. Why do you see these are the four critical pieces here?
Well, the way we see it, I guess, is we've made micro steps with the climate security risk assessment. We talked quite a lot about the work that was done in the Office of National Intelligence on looking at climate change consequences from an external perspective. And nothing from that report has ever been released into the public domain, even though we've run that agenda ourselves and we've had parliamentarians also running that same agenda without success. We conclude that the findings of the ONI report are so frightening the government doesn't want us to know about it. But the real truth of the matter is, irrespective of what the government sees as being important or not, these things are happening to us, and they're happening to us now. The real truth is that if we can't take a serious, transparent and honest look at consequences and the likelihood of things happening more quickly than we ever thought, then we can hardly prepare ourselves for dealing with what is about to happen to us. And I like to put it this way. We live in a region that's got 5 billion people plus in it, a region which is going to be without significant supplies of fresh water in the next decade or two, a region where they will not be able to grow enough food to feed themselves, and a region which displacements will be a common thing, and we will all be subject to those displacements. So a country like Bangladesh, for example, which virtually has no way of being able to solve its climate change problems, will put on the road over 100 million people looking for somewhere else to live. These are the kinds of consequences that are, we say, make this a more certain and a more dangerous world than anything we've ever seen.
There's also the aspect with General Middendorp's speech to Australian audiences that this regional cooperation and support might be an aspect that we need to move on as well. In terms of the progress here on a monitoring system, on global cooperation, where do we sit on that front? What kind of steps do you think we need to be taking at this present time?
It's micro steps. We've been reading recently of the furor in the Bureau of Meteorology in the lead up to the last election because people weren't allowed to talk to the truth. We've seen now the Bureau put out more dire warnings about weather consequences. We've seen this security risk assessment kept into the bureaucracy and it's not involving communities. If you go to the northern rivers of New South Wales, for example, and ask them what they think the future looks like, I think people might be stunned at how depressing that story is with flood after flood that was not expected and people whose homes have been destroyed year after year. Now, these are the kinds of issues that eventually will lead to a loss of confidence in our government. They will lead to civil action by communities that have fed up with not being looked after properly. On top of that, we'll have displaced people coming to this country. That's not the kind of Australia that I look forward to in the future. And the real truth is that's the kind of Australia we need to start preparing ourselves for and making sure we're properly equipped to deal with the things that we can think about.
Do you see a role here for military alliances like NATO and Quad and other forums to elevate this issue of being able to respond in a worst-case scenario when we talk about climate security threats?
Well, not especially, because we military people are really brought up to think about the worst things that might happen and how we can prepare to head them off. I spent 42 years doing that kind of work, and when I look at some of the things that we were able to achieve by taking that position, we were remarkably successful. But when we look around now, I think the points that are really important, and we all should consider them. Firstly, no one person can solve this problem on climate change. It's asking all of us on the planet today to do something to head it off. Secondly, I think the international system is finding it very difficult to make any real concrete steps in advancing towards a solution for managing potential consequences. We've seen COP after COP take place, but not much progress. Does anybody seriously think that the agreements that were made in Paris in 2015 are anywhere near as well tendered as they ought to be? Or are we actually looking at continuing rising greenhouse gas emissions, continuing threats to the environment year after year, with a potential heading towards 3 degrees Celsius of warming, which is a position that no scientist will give you a statement about.
I'm reading here the outline here of General Middendorp's address. He's saying the security sector needs to be part of the whole of government effort to address these climate risks. And in your view, do we see that happening at this stage? That I know your voice has been quite vocal about this, but others within the security sector beyond the government really recognising the situation?
Well, I think there are a whole range of factors why we're not having as much say as we ought to. I go back to the military thinking, always looking ahead and preparing for what might happen. I wrote was part of a four-person team that wrote a paper in 2015 where we looked at climate change consequences and what it meant for the Australian Defence Force. Did that change anything? No, it didn't. Were we able to get any traction out of those findings? No, we were not. We've seen this potential time to get things done properly has been eroded, evaporated over the last 15 years or so. So now we have to take such drastic action that it is going to affect people quite dramatically. If you look across the whole panoply of our lifestyles, and I know a current government might focus on cost of living issues and all these sorts of things, but you know, go back to $230 billion of damage in one state in the United States by one hurricane, a state which called itself immune from climate change consequences, and ask ourselves, if that was to happen to us, what would it really look like? Firstly, nothing's insurable. It's beyond the reach of any insurance capacity. Two, we'd be totally unprepared on how to deal with. There will be people whose lives will be utterly destroyed by the consequences of that. And of course, the other problem is it's very hard to see it coming with advance warning. These weather events are happening. They're much more extreme. And like Helene, the early predictions was it was nothing much to worry about. It's dropped 50% more rain in North Carolina than had been predicted. We've seen that here. We saw that in the Northern Rivers. We've seen it on the east coast of Australia, and we've seen it in Western Australia as well. These are the things that have happened to us in the last 5 years or so. And if they're not serious warning signs that we really do need to take climate action seriously, then I don't know what is.
In terms of the regional aspects, we know that Pacific Island nations in particular are seeing very severe consequences from the climate threat in terms of impacts on even thoughts of migration, climate refugees. In terms of Asia Pacific and how that regionally plays out as this threat of a flashpoint of a threat of war, how do you see that?
You know, it's very easy to dream up scenarios, but let me explain my concerns this way. The Himalayan glacier is disappearing. The Himalayan glacier used to melt every year and provide reliable supplies of fresh water from countries from China all the way around to Afghanistan. So you look at the Asian continent, in our region, a region of about over 5 billion people, and suddenly a reliable supply of fresh water is disappearing because of climate change consequences. What does it mean in terms of our capacity to give people fresh water to drink? And what does it mean in terms of our capacity to grow the food that we need? It has very significant consequences. Now, there is one country that's doing something about it that I know of, and that's China. China is already trying to capture a lot of that water, and that's creating concerns in all the other countries that depend on it as well. Because if I divert the water upstream from my country, then I don't get it. So these kinds of low-level actions are happening right now. But here's the real rub. When people are going without, so people are starving, people don't have homes, people are flapping around in seawater as they're going to be in the Pacific Islands, they will start to do things which are desperate. They will act in ways that don't allow proper governance as we understand it. And then we have no way of knowing where that ends up. That's the kind of thing that General Middendorf is pointing to.